to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, we're going to be talking about a couple of really interesting topics on the show. Honey and beekeeping starts, and then we'll switch to winemaking and wine. So honey and wine today, and we've got a couple of guests to start talking about beekeeping and honey. One of them, Drew Kaiser, is a partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. Drew's been a prominent advocate for beekeeping in western Wisconsin for more than a decade, I believe, particularly urban beekeeping. And last year, his company had 65 colonies in 15 locations. Drew Kaiser, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
With us as well, Emily Cedo is the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen. She's also studying ag and applied economics and public policy at UW-Madison. Emily, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, really great to have you in the studio. Give us a question. Give us a call with your questions. Maybe you've got a question about making honey. Maybe you want to start your own beehive. Whether you live in the city or country, I believe you can do it in most cases. And I hope you'll share your experiences, or maybe you don't have any experience, you just have questions. Well, we'll love those as well. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Emily, you're the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen. What does that title entail?
So as the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen, I get to travel all across Wisconsin and serve as a promoter for the honey industry and its products, along with being an educator, being able to do presentations to civics groups, or just kind of being out and about at expos.
So what kinds of demonstrations do you do?
So actually, at the Wisconsin State Fair, I will be there all of the days, and I do cooking demonstrations on the main stage. So doing things with honey and just kind of showing some really cool recipes.
How did you get involved in this in the first place? Do you have a background in, I don't believe you do have your own hive or anything.
So I don't have my own hive, but I grew up very immersed in agriculture from a young age with goats and horses. And then on our separate family farm, we do lots of crops. So we'd always ask beekeepers to keep their bees on our land as it really helps with our yields. And it also helps get some pretty cool honey varieties.
Yeah, I bet. And that brings me to Drew. Drew Kaiser, tell us a bit about what you do at Kaiserson Bee Company.
Yeah. Well, as you alluded to, I've been at it for over a decade. I think this is going to be my 15th season keeping bees. And we do things a little bit differently than most beekeepers. We really emphasize urban beekeeping as well as some rural beekeeping. So we started, my wife and I, when I say we, Kaiserson is myself and Ellen Sorensen, so hence Kaiserson. And we place small numbers of colonies around the Chippewa Valley and pull little bits of honey off of them as the bees allow us to, and jar them by their individual location and dates, which is really kind of an interesting exercise because we're able to lock in very different nectar flows from different plants, which gives us anything from almost water white, crystal clear honey to jet black honey and in between. And so we like sharing the flavors and the story about what the bees do with all the people that will listen.
And you have some new infused products as well?
Yeah. We've been working with the state of Wisconsin and just received our food processing license from DATCAP. And so within the last couple of days, we've actually just launched a hot honey line. And we're doing a lavender infused line initially as well, looking to increase that in the coming weeks and months with things like tea-infused line. So we're working with Tony over at Sacred Blossom Farm in Mondovi to identify different herbs that he thinks are going to work well with the honey profiles we have. And we're really all about collaboration. So we've worked with distilleries and breweries. We've worked with bakers. We love to work with farmers. And we like to explore the difference that we can get from honey and the different ways to use it.
I have some very good friends who own Gentle Breeze Honey in Mount Horeb, and they produce a hot honey. How hot is hot? I mean, I love their hot honey. It's a different kind of a.
You know, we're in the Midwest, so we try not to scorch people's faces off. Our initial product is definitely much more of a glimmer of chili flavor. So we do a mixture of honey, various different chilies, a little bit of cinnamon, and then a touch of vinegar. So it's really a nice condiment to be able to use on savory foods. We like the contrast. Yeah.
Sounds really good. Emily, do you ever use hot honey in any of your demonstrations?
I have not, but I was just recently introduced to it back in February. It was a peach habanero mix. It was pretty solid.
you like, was it hot, really hot, or was it?
You know, the initial, it was very nice. And then after it sat for about 5 minutes, it started to kick in a little bit more.
There's a little bit of an afterburn there.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, man. Talking honey with Emily Cito, who's our Wisconsin honey queen, and Drew Kaiser, partner in Kaiser's and Bee Company in Eau Claire. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Emily, how popular is beekeeping in Wisconsin? You probably have some facts and figures running around your head.
Just a little bit. Wisconsin ranks 11th in beekeeping. So in past years, we've been in top 10. And mm-hmm. So we just tend to fluctuate. And in Wisconsin, we can produce around 3 million pounds each year. But not every beekeeper does submit their data into the survey and stuff like that. So again, beekeeping does fluctuate year to year.
And back to you, Drew. How much honey do you produce each year?
Well, we're pretty small potatoes compared to some of the agriculture, the larger beekeepers. I think last year was about 2 tons, so about 4,000 pounds of honey.
A lot of honey. It's a lot of honey. Nina in Abbotsford has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Nina.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I know there are bird baths, and then I've been reading about places for bees to drink water and how to go about that. And maybe then not to attract the wasps and the hornets.
Well, probably if you're going to get one, you're going to get the other, Drew. I don't know. What do you think?
To some extent, I think that you're likely to see bees a little bit more than wasps and hornets. Their honeybee colonies tend to be significantly larger than some of those other stinging cousins may be. In terms of the how, the big thing is about creating a situation in which they can land. And so they really love mud. If you look at creek beds and the shores around them, that's a common place for a lot of our insect pollinators to be able to go and drink from. So you mentioned a bird bath. A really great way to adapt a bird bath is to add some stones or some marbles or just a few hard objects kind of in the middle of it to allow for bees to land and take a drink and be able to fly back off of that.
So you could do the birds and the bees.
Birds and the bees, yeah.
there you go, Nina. That's what I had in the back of my mind. They need someplace to land. They can't land in the water.
Yeah, and honeybee colonies, on some of those hot summer days, they're going to be drinking upwards of a gallon of water or so. There's, 60 to 80,000 honeybees in a single colony. And so their water needs are pretty significant. And those foragers do a lot of work to bring enough water back to the colony.
Yeah, I would guess. Lisa in Madison sent us an email and wants us to cover colony collapse. She heard that it was worse this year. Emily, you want to start?
This year, Wisconsin, we've definitely seen a large amount of colonies kind of losing their big numbers. And from what I understand of it, we don't really have an exact, researchers don't have an exact kind of reason. It just kind of happened. And I think, Drew, you might have a little more firsthand experience with that.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, I do.
No.
You know, it's a cyclical thing. You know, as Emily said, there's things that get pointed to, but we don't really have a good reason as to why one year it may be bad versus another year. You know, we really saw, obviously, colony collapse disorder rear its head in the early 2000s. And since then, it's ebbed and flowed, and we've had really good years, and we've had really bad years. The reports I'm hearing out of California this year is that the quality of colony health is significantly below what they're hoping for, mm-hmm. what they would usually demand of pollinators going into the orchards. You know, they're basically accepting half-strength colonies in order to make sure that they have enough pollinators on different crops. But, you know, certainly we look at land use, chemical use, air and water quality issues. But there's just a whole host of new diseases that are continually kind of cropping up and showing that, you know, we need to focus on making sure that pollinators are healthy to keep us healthy, keep our food healthy. So,
Drew, you place your bees in somewhat urban areas pretty often. Mm-hmm. What's your reasoning on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, getting back to kind of the roots of why my wife and then initially I got into beekeeping, it was on campus at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. And so we actually started with urban beekeeping, and that kind of spurred our interest in looking at, you know, a community like Eau Claire that has a lot to offer. You know, we're a very green city. We're not large by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a lot of kind of urban agricultural activities happening inside of our borders. And there was some promising, be it often anecdotal information, that was showing that bees fared better in a lot of circumstances being in urban environments than some rural environments. And so we kind of, you know, we see, like colony collapse disorder, some years our urban bees do way better, some years our rural bees do way better. It's kind of a way of us to hedge our bets. You know, the nice thing about being small and being diffuse in our area is that we may see one location that doesn't do great, but most of our locations will do.
Yeah. And there's got to be, I was going to say there's got to be a difference in flavor, but maybe not as much. But there,
it's stark. You know, I think that one of my favorite things is giving people a taste of honey from June, honey from July, honey from August and September from one location, and having them be blown away at the variety and the difference between them. You know, most things that honeybees are interested in foraging off of are really only in bloom for a few weeks. And so you kind of let the bees do their own blending and make different little concoctions of nectar that you can then offer to people to try the difference of what our area has to offer. So even a few miles difference and a few weeks difference can offer radically different honeys.
And so you need to be a little able to kind of go with the flow, so to speak. So, and how you market or how you talk about the various honeys that you have to sell.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the nature of what I do is very, educational, very hands-on. It's definitely the sort of thing where, it's not, it's not immediately apparent to people to look at a jar of our honey on the shelf and understand exactly what they're going to get out of it. I would say that most people are fairly familiar with that kind of golden colored honey bear that sits on the shelf. Most of the honey that we get is probably clover honey or and when I say we, most of the honey that people are familiar with from a grocery store perspective tends to be clover honey and some mix of wildflower or other familiar flowers. And so the honey at grocery stores tends to be blended to a fairly average flavor profile so that people can expect that they're getting the same thing off of the shelf every time.
Our guest today, Emily Cito, the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen, and Drew Kaiser, partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. Questions for them, give a call. I see we have lots of emails. You can, and if you want to add to those, go to talk@wpr.org or give us a call. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking honey and beekeeping today with our two guests, Honey Queen for Wisconsin in 2025, Emily Cito, and Drew Kaiser with us as well. He's a partner in Kaiserson Bee Company out of Eau Claire. So great to have both of them with us today. And you can join in. We had someone wondering if you, and I think that this goes to you, Drew, did you say black honey?
Yeah. Yeah. You can have some honey that is, you know, almost as dark and opaque as molasses. I think the one that probably comes to mind for most people would be buckwheat honey. But we get some late season honeys. I come to understand that sumac honey can be a darker one. And up around here, the last few seasons, I've been getting honey off of... knotweed, Japanese knotweed, which is, you know, highly invasive plant.
Yeah.
Fairly noxious, but makes a honey that is kind of, it's brambly. You know, it tastes like chocolate-covered raspberries or something.
Chocolate-covered raspberries, that'd be pretty good.
It's amazing. I mean, we can't keep it, you know, more than a month or so.
And it's gone.
Not that I'm not going to go out and plant Japanese knotweed. Don't worry.
Oh man, Emily, the flavors. Do you use a broad range of them when you're doing your cooking and demonstrations?
I definitely do. Like Drew mentioned, kind of our clover honey or wildflower is very common, very light. Tend to use it in salad dressings or mixing it in with your coffee and tea. And then just recently, I was donated some locusts. Honey, which is pretty rare to get from what I've heard. And so I'm super excited to start using that. And I mean, really, the honey you can even use in meat dressings or kind of marinating stuff like that. The flavors are just really, really diverse. And we have 30 different flavor or varieties in Wisconsin and then 300 in the U.S. and 3,000 worldwide.
That's a lot of varieties, for sure. And so you're telling me that the honey can be used in your mind for certain desserts come to mind right away, but also salads, main courses.
It really can
appetizers.
Be anything. It's so versatile, and you can also get creamed honeys. So I love putting that on my bagels. I have a cinnamon creamed honey, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I know Gentle Breeze makes that too, and I love to put that on bagels as well. Have you done any of that yet, Drew? The cream kind of honey? Like it looks like white butter almost, you know?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I have not at the moment, but it is kind of in my scopes for the future. It's a wonderful product. To build on what Emily was saying, you know, and kind of your question, Larry, I think honey works as a really lovely complement and contrast to a lot of different. So I look at sour foods, I look at bitter foods, I look at salty foods, fatty foods, you know. Gosh, I can't put enough on pizza at this point. Think about a slice of pepperoni pizza with a drizzle of honey. It's a perfect combination of sweet and salty and fatty. We've got a pizza place in Eau Claire that uses it on one of their pies, and it's a favorite of everyone.
You know, I've got a daughter coming to visit me in a couple of days, and she likes pizza. I'm going to try that. I've never had it on pizza. Had it practically every other way, but never on pizza. You just drizzle it on or what?
Yeah. I was in Colorado a few years ago, and they were claiming the mantle that it was Colorado style pizza, I guess. But I think we can take the claim for it here in Wisconsin.
Ann in Eau Claire has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi, we are big Kaiser Sun Honey fans, so glad to hear both your guests. But wondering if you can solve an argument between my husband and I. I insist that we need to use a wood implement to serve our honey and spread it. And he doesn't believe that it actually affects any of the qualities of the honey to use a metal implement. So would love to hear from our experts what they think.
Well, you know, the implements are always wooden that I've ever seen, Drew or Emily.
I hate to get in the middle of a marital argument. I don't. Would you like to take this, Emily, or would you like me to?
Go ahead, Emily. You start, and then Drew can chime in.
You know, I personally have always used wooden. It feels the right of way as for what I was always told what to do. And I do think it does matter. But I think, Drew, you might be able to speak a little more on the logistics and science behind it.
Yeah, and the wooden ones are usually, they look kind of like almost a corkscrew or something, and you kind of roll it in, and I think it's easier.
A honey dipper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so this has been coming around a lot. I know there were some social media images that were saying that metal was potentially destructive to honey. And so I think that there's some truth and some untruths in that particular conversation. So first and foremost, I'll say that almost every piece of equipment that beekeepers are going to use is made out of metal. The extractor, the tools, the uncapping knife, you know, there's a significant amount of stainless steel in the process of harvesting your honey. So where I think that conversation is coming from is the fact that honey is a lightly acidic solution, which means that it's going to be reactive with certain types of metals. So I would say you absolutely never want to store a spoon in your honey, because long-term contact with an acidic substance like honey could lead to some metallic taste coming into the honey. But something as simple as serving honey with a spoon, I don't think is going to make a tremendous difference. You know, the amount of, you're going to lick that off before it's going to cause any sort of problems. The other aspect of things is that, you know, there's kind of an older take to it. Most silverware nowadays is likely stainless steel and is a low reactivity metal. If you're talking about truly silverware, I would probably avoid using that. There's a higher amount of reactivity with silver. So a little bit, both of you are correct. I think use the implement that makes you most happy, and I don't think that it's going to cause too much of a difference.
And I'm with you, Ann. I'd use the wood. Tell him Larry said he always uses the wood. Thanks for calling. Glenn in Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Hi. Some years ago, I took a beekeeping course with Bend County Beekeepers, and it was surprising to me to learn how much sugar was required to overwinter the bees. So my question is, what is the ratio of sugar fed during the winter compared to the honey produced in the honey season?
So now you're not pouring a bunch of sugar granulated sugar into those hives. Are you, Drew?
That's generally not the process. I mean, so Glenn is absolutely correct. You know, in northern climates, it takes a tremendous amount of food to get honeybees through winter. You know, when you look at a lot of the bigger commercial beekeepers, they're going to put their hives on the back of a truck, and they're going to take them to California, Texas, Georgia, Florida. They're going to take them to warm environments where they don't have to deal with what we Wisconsinites have to deal with in winter. But there are plenty of beekeepers that do keep them here. And generally speaking, I think the University of Minnesota Bee Lab is kind of the experts in northern climate beekeeping. And they tend to say that you want 75 to 100 pounds of honey on a bee colony in order to get them successfully through winter.
And when you're talking about a colony, you're talking about one of those boxes that you see out in the field or whatever.
Well, so, you know, just a little bit of vocab. It's colloquially, we'll call a colony or a hive kind of the same thing, but the hive is the package that the organisms are in. The mm-hmm. colony is the collection of organisms. So the colony is actually the queen, the workers, and the drones that live inside of a hive. But we kind of, you know, there's one colony in one hive, generally speaking, so we use them interchangeably.
Okay.
But, you know, so 75 to 100 pounds of honey is a significant amount. And beekeeping is an expensive activity. So a lot of beekeepers will over-harvest from a colony the honey that they've produced and then supplement with beet sugar or white granulated sugar in order to get them up to the appropriate amount of feed for all of winter time. Honestly, I've been noticing that the winter die-off from the last several years, they don't touch most of the food that they have stored. The issue is largely never starvation for bees around here. I shouldn't say never, but it's more likely that it's going to be some combination of pests. So a Varroa destructor mite is kind of the number one pest that we look at. And when you have an infestation of mites, you almost always then have any combination of viral, bacterial, and then also fungal issues that start to weaken and make the colonies less likely to survive through winter.
Thanks very much, Glenn, for your question and comments. And so that sugar, it's in a kind of a syrup form and poured into what do you do?
Yeah. You'll make so there's light syrup and there's heavy syrup. Going into winter, we'll feed a heavy syrup. So it's about a weight ratio between water and white sugar. So moving in the fall, you'll feed them 1-to-1. One part water to one part sugar. In the springtime, you actually want a lighter syrup, something that's offering them some extra water going into the colony. So you'll do a 2-to-1 syrup at that point. So, you know, on a colony, it's not unrealistic throughout the course of the year to supplement, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 pounds of white sugar. You only do that during times of the year when the bees aren't bringing in honey, and only into parts of the colony that you would not be harvesting honey from. You know, there's a real adulteration problem, unfortunately, with imported honeys specifically. Mm. But, you know, we want to make sure that the honey that we're gathering into the super boxes of the colony are just nectar, botanically derived sources.
We lots of callers online and plenty of emails too. Ellie emailed us, how much does it cost to get started as a backyard honey producer? Any ideas on that, Emily?
Ideally, first you want to start with your beekeeping courses, and depending on those can fluctuate in how much it costs to attend. And I know there's lots of beekeepers in Wisconsin who do those courses, and it's they're so phenomenal with it. But equipment and hive boxes, you really could look around $1,000 to $2,000, just really getting started. But yeah. every beekeeper is different, and I feel like it comes down to kind of your preference with equipment and tools.
And you were nodding in agreement there, Drew, I think.
Yeah, well, and you hit the nail on the head. It's all about a preference. There's a lot of beekeepers who have a great wood shop and access to lots of pine boards. So, I mean, nothing in the woodenware of beekeeping is tremendously difficult to make on your own. So if you're willing to do it yourself, you can certainly pay less to get the equipment necessary. If you want to buy it all kind of ready to go out of a box, it's going to cost a lot more. So there's a pretty significant sliding scale. Just to add a couple extra, you know, so you've got your woodenware. So there's boxes, and inside those boxes, there are frames. And I should say that's one particular style of colony. There are frameless styles where there's just a top bar that the bees can build wax onto. You've got tools, you've got suits, you've got smokers, you know, like any hobby. I would say if you're talking about getting started in your backyard, you're likely talking about a hobby scale initially, and hopefully you get some honey enough to sell. But you want to go into it with a measured amount of expectation that the first year you might not get a harvest. Successive years after the comb has been built out by your colony in there, it's much more likely that you're going to be able to keep some of the honey that they produce. But it is kind of a, you know, it's a never-ending pit of money that you can spend money on.
Yeah, I'm sure it can be. Oh, man. Bob in Madison has a question, I believe.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Larry. Very timely in light of some of the recent media reports that we've been seeing about honeybees that are used in agricultural pollination and the potential losses among those hives. I'm wondering, would you expect that to be reflected in our Wisconsin honeybees, or is this a separate issue? And also, what can the rest of us do to, or not do, to help honeybees?
Okay, well, let's turn to Emily first, and then we'll get Drew to chime in. Hi, go ahead, Emily.
I can touch on the second half and let Drew kind of touch on that first part of it. He just has more experience with that, and I think he'd be able to share a better perspective. But right now, the DNR just recently released a webpage of shops around Wisconsin that you can get your native flowers and plants from. And so really creating a diverse habitat for the honeybees is just so vital in making sure that they have enough resources to go and pollinate and get their nectar and pollen and just kind of all that from. And basically, one out of every three bites of food we take is due to pollination, and 80% of that is our honeybees. So really making sure that we have those sources for them to pollinate and their habitat, it really plays such a big role in Wisconsin agriculture.
Yeah. Drew, comment?
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100% agree. You know, in terms of what people can do in their own yards or area, is to make sure there's always something in bloom. Try and minimize the amount of chemicals that you put out into the environment, and certainly just be conscientious of what sort of practices you're using. In terms of Bob's first part of the question, I think there's no doubt it's going to have an impact on Wisconsin honeybee population to some extent. You know, the folks who are doing agricultural pollination are doing that across the country. You know, there's very few large-scale beekeepers that would keep their colonies just in Wisconsin and insulate themselves from what's been happening in California and other parts of the country this winter. And honeybees are a highly social creature. And so because we've set up our agricultural system to move the populations around and concentrate them during different parts of the year, we certainly see some spread of disease that takes place because of that. But it's not necessarily doom and gloom. The great thing about honeybees as a commercial pollinator is that their life cycle is short enough that we can manage them. You know, we're able to take colonies that have some vigor, and we can turn one into multiple. And so commercial beekeepers have been doing this for a long time. And I think that you know, in terms of meeting our needs for pollination, I'm not particularly concerned about that. But I do think that you'll see some effect at some point from the losses we've seen.
Bob, thanks again. Let's go to another Bob in Manitowoc County. Bob, hi.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you for the subject matter. I'm a first-year beekeeper, and I really appreciate the insight that Drew and Emily are sharing. My first question is for Drew. Hey, Drew, in your hives, what do you use as a moisture absorber during the wintertime?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a couple of different routes that I go. Depending upon what sort of food reserves you have in your colony, a good defense towards moisture and starvation is a candy board. So creating basically a shim box that can sit on top of your colony with a hardened block of sugar. In times of need, it's going to be there for them if they're running low on their honey supplies and need to tap into it as they breed. So, you know, honeybees are alive through all of winter, and there's respiration creating moisture. And so one of the big killers of honeybees, as Bob alluded to, is moisture in the winter time. You know, we get these fairly significant swings in temperature that happen from day to night. And so then we get condensation that happens on the lid of our colonies and rains down and will basically drown or chill out the bees because there's too much moisture. So the benefit of a candy board is that turns into foodstuffs that they can readily access and use in a timely fashion. I'll also use, there's a fiber board. This is what University of Minnesota often recommends using. It's a construction grade fiber board. You can find it at most home improvement stores. Oftentimes it's going to have kind of a waterproofing coating on one side and an absorptive side on the other side. They come in 4x8 sheets that you'd have to cut down to fit on top of your colony, but those tend to work really great, at least for a season or two. They're soft enough that bees can potentially start to chew through them, and they certainly will hold a lot of moisture. So I've found some seasons coming out of winter that they might get a little moldy, and I just chuck them. I've heard of people who will use kind of like a quilt box. So basically a full box that's then been filled with either wool. Some people will use dry leaf matter, wood shavings. The great thing and the hard thing about beekeeping is that there are a lot of different methods to accomplish all of the same things. So there's a lot of room for experimentation to see what works for you. And unfortunately, what works for you one year might not work for you the next year, because winter is kind of a target for us.
Yeah. So there you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Talking honey and beekeeping today with Emily Cito, who is the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen, and Drew Kaiser, a partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk honey and beekeeping with Emily Cito and Drew Kaiser. They're doing a great job here. And lots of people online and on the phone, and we'll get to them in just a second. But one thing I haven't mentioned yet, and I want to be sure to do it before the end of the show, is the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo, which is coming up April 12th. Emily, start with you. What could people see and learn? And you're both going to be there. You're nodding yes. Yeah. So what can people see there, Emily?
Each expo I go to is different. So at the Fond du Lac Ag Showcase, you could catch me handing out cheese samples. And for the other half of the day, I was kind of promoting honey and standing with some other Wisconsin honey producers who are selling their honey here at different shows. And so you'll probably catch me walking around, hanging out, chatting with some of the beekeepers, and just really there to answer any questions, talk, take pictures. I'm there.
And Drew, there are several educational opportunities and some fun too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of great presentations set up for the day, as well as demonstrations. I'll be giving kind of the what you need to know to get started presentation over the lunch hour. But I know we've got some conversations about mites and wintering bees, cooking with honey. There's a lot of different folks. There's over 40 vendors. There's going to be youth activities and food trucks, planting for pollinators, you know, sustainable living. There's a lot of different resources and chances to kind of find a way to be involved with honeybees and beekeeping.
Yeah, it sounds great. And it's at the Northern Wisconsin State Fairgrounds, which I've been to, done some shows up there. And it's a good place because there's lots of parking. There's lots of, you know, you don't have to worry about that stuff.
If you want to find more information, too, you can go to bee-expo.org, and there's information and tickets available there as well.
bee-expo.org. There we go.
Okay.
And it's, again, the date is April 12th.
And coming that's up quick.
And that's no April Fool's joke either. It is April, and runs all day, doesn't it?
It'll be from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
9 to 4. There we go. Jerry in Verona, your turn now. Thanks for joining in.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a good friend who's a master gardener, and she's real kind of into indigenous plants and insects and that sort of thing. And she read something that there might be an issue that a lot of beekeepers use European bees, which could be maybe considered like an invasive species. Is there anything to that?
Well, Emily, we start with you and then let Drew chime in.
So beekeepers use a whole different variety of species. So there are your European bees, even Italian, Russian. You can get some mixes in there as well. And they all bring different qualities to beekeeping, whether they are better in the winter, produce more honey, more docile. It really, you can use so many different varieties. And they are technically invasive to the U.S., but they're just recently there's been some scientific discovery of what we presume to be the European honeybee that was found quite a few years ago here in the U.S. So it's really kind of a toss-up.
Drew, what do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say invasive. There's a fairly technical definition to that implies that they're persistent and problematic. They're non-native for sure. So my Latin isn't super great, but as Emily was alluding to, we use Apis mellifera or Apis mellifera, the honey-bearing bee, which is often referred to as the Western or the European honeybee. And so when she was talking about Italians or Russians, those are subspecies of the same genus species, Apis mellifera. It's not necessarily that they are bad, but what makes them good at being agricultural pollinators also makes them potentially problematic in terms of how they can compete for resources in an area. And so what they're great for is being able to go to a place like Central Valley, California, where there's nothing but almond orchards and no sustainable forage for native bees to persist throughout the year and to pollinate crops that require insect pollination. In terms of being in an area where there is diverse forage and there is native populations, I think it's fairly incumbent upon beekeepers to be responsible about not overpopulating an area with honeybees, because those 60 to 80,000 honeybees in a colony can go out and rob nectar from flowers that could otherwise be beneficial to some of the native bees. You know, in Wisconsin, we have something like 300 or so native species. Most of the bees that we would see are going to be bumblebee species. Different genus. The Bombus genus is the bumblebee species. There's 12 or 15 bumblebees that are endemic to Wisconsin. And then a lot of the vast majority of native bee species are actually solitary stingless bees that most people aren't going to really see in their day-to-day lives, because as the name implies, there's a solitary situation in which they lay their eggs. And so you see very few of them, few and far between.
Nina in Menasha, your turn. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a fantastic, it's just a fascinating, bees are wonderful. But, and thank you for the show. I just read something, I'm very ignorant on beekeeping, but I like to learn. And I just want, I read an article that blew my mind, is I assumed bees, you know, are pollinating everything and liked all flowers. But those of you who are planting a garden or, you know, planning shrubbery or landscaping, look up plants or flowers that bees do not like or can't or do not pollinate. I didn't even know that was a thing.
It is indeed, and it comes up a lot. And I know that some of the organizations, like the beekeeper organizations, are interested in native plants as, you know, for flower-type situations, Drew.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was Jerry that mentioned his friend, the Master Gardener. Most Master Gardener organizations maintain pretty good lists of different pollinator-friendly plants that you can get in each area. I think focusing on native plants is a really good way of being able to kind of bridge the divide between those native pollinators that need support and honeybees. You know, when we talk about, you hear a lot of folks say things like save the bees. And as much as I got into beekeeping initially because I heard about colony collapse disorder, I felt a need to do something in this sphere. The bees that really need our saving are those native bees, you know, the ones that are a little less often seen, but do a really important job in our ecosystem. You know, we're home to the rusty patch bumblebee, which was actually the first bee species to be listed as critically endangered. We've seen them in Eau Claire in the last few years, but we certainly don't see them as often as we used to. And so by planting native plants, we hopefully give some of those species a fighting chance to be able to persist on and play the role they need to play.
Richard emailed us, should you store your honey in a glass bottle rather than plastic? Emily?
That's an interesting question. With honey shows, you know, you always have to have them in the glass bottles for judging, and you got to be weary about your fingerprints and the lids and the bubbles. But I don't know, Drew, do you prefer glass or honey, or what's your take on that?
You know, I prefer glass myself for a number of reasons, but I don't think there's a significant disadvantage to storing honey in glass on face, I guess I should say. The disadvantage to storing honey in plastic is it's harder to reliquify if you want to, you know. So yeah, Raw honey is going to crystallize and become solid, which I and a lot of people enjoy eating, but a lot of people want their honey to be fluid, and being in plastic doesn't really offer you a good chance to do that without potentially melting the jar. So glass is a great option that way.
And on that note, I'm so sorry. We've got lots of callers online, and we've got lots of emails that we haven't gotten to, but it means that we'll have to do this again. So I want to thank you.
You'll have to come to the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo.
That would be fun. April 12th is the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo, and our guests have been Emily Cito, our Wisconsin Honey Queen for 2025, and Drew Kaiser, partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. Thank you both very much, and thank you so much for listening. And hey, stay with us. We're talking honey. Next, we're going to talk about wine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today here on WPR News, Larry Mealer. And we're turning our attention from honey to wine, although I think honey may play a role in some of the wine that you may be drinking from time to time. Philippe Coquart back with us. He's president and winemaker at Wallersheim Winery and Distillery in Prairie du Sac. He's from the Beaujolais region of France originally, and comes from a winemaking family. Philippe, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
C'est me, Larry. What a pleasure to be on your show again.
Oh, it's great to have you here, as it is to have Céline Coquart-Leonards as the head winemaker at Wallersheim Winery now, and, of course, Philippe's daughter. Céline, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, it's great to have you both here. And as we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in. Want to hear from you. Let us know which Wisconsin wines are your favorite, or maybe you have a question about wine. Or maybe you've got some grapes of your own growing at home and you have questions about those grapes. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Céline, let's turn to you first. You've got a new role at Wallersheim. You're the head winemaker. What does that title mean?
So I am looking at all of our wines from start to finish. So basically when the bottles get to our homes. So that means out in the vineyard more with Philippe, my dad. And it also means making those decisions of what wines we're going to make, from which fields, how we're making them, the yeast that we're choosing, how sweet we want them to be after fermentation, how we plan to age them, whether that's in the tank, in the bottle, in the barrel, and when those wines are ready to be bottled and shared with everybody.
So from one end to the other, and I am expecting that you've kind of prepared for this role for a long time. Talk about that.
Yeah, like any family business, it is a lifelong adventure. Really, officially, I originally thought I wanted to go into medicine, so that's not... I ended up somewhere different. But I started in horticulture at UW-Madison and then realized I loved fermentation science and sensory perception and got really interested in the winemaking after working in the vineyard for quite a few years. But even just growing up before I realized what I wanted to do as an adult, I spent all those meals growing up tasting wine, drinking wine, but not just wine, food too. The experience of tasting different foods, whether it's fruits, vegetables, and also being outside. We spend a lot of time out in the garden and out in the yard, and the smell of fresh cut grass, or, you know, when you put a little piece of grass in your mouth and chew on the end of it, all those flavors are kind of a way of building up that wine library as a young person going into winemaking.
Yeah. And Philippe, you know, it's been a while since you've been on, unfortunately. I think it'd be worth it to talk a little bit about the history of Wallersheim Winery and how you got involved in it as well.
Yeah, sure. My pleasure. So Wallersheim Winery is 35 minute northwest of Madison. It is a very historic winery. The site was founded in 1847. The grape growers in 1852 came from Germany, built the winery that we still use, the cellar, and we use the old winery, like we have for 50 years as Wallersheim Winery. Grapes were grown on site until the Prohibition. The grapes were Native American grapes such as Concord, Catawba, Delaware, Niagara. Sometime around 1876, they made brandy to increase the alcohol content of the Native American grapes. 1919, Prohibition happened and everything closed down. as an old winery until 1972, when my wife's parents, my in-laws, Bob and Joanne Wollersheim, bought the property and restarted everything from scratch, growing French-American hybrids that can take 25 below zero. And later on, sometime in the 80s, late 80s, we started to grow Wisconsin hybrids, Minnesota hybrids, which are thriving in this cold climate. And today we grow 30 some acres on site. We have a lot of grapes custom grown in Wisconsin. Just to close the loop, and it was so interesting, Larry, to connect with you guys, because I remember you interviewing Bob and I in the early days. And for a while, it was me by myself. And then I thought, it would be a blessing to introduce Celine to the world of radio and kind of closing the loop. And I've been the winemaker for 40 years, and Celine has been with us over 12 years. And as an employee, as a kid, many more years. So it's a natural evolution of the business that she becomes the winemaker and I spend more time in the vineyard and so on. But it's a joy to see her thrive in what she loves to do.
Yeah, it's got to be a real joy to you and thrill, as a matter of fact. Jeremy in Manitowoc has a question for Celine, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, so my question for Celine is, now that you're the head winemaker, are there any Wisconsin varietals that you want to work with or maybe add or replant in your vineyard to do your own thing and move forward? Anything that that's different than what you guys are doing now?
Thanks, Jeremy. That's a great question. Last year, we planted two new varietals, both Wisconsin Minnesota hybrids, the Crimson Pearl and Petite Pearl. So in the next few years, once they're mature enough to start harvesting, then we'll be experimenting with some different wines out of those. We just in the last year, we've been adding some new wines. We have a Marquette Rosé that we call the Garden Rosé, and that's a dry rosé. That's been a different one for us. That's our first 100% Marquette wine. And then I also started the Locale, which is made with 100% La Crosse, another Wisconsin hybrid. So I'm really focusing on using some of the Wisconsin hybrids as we're phasing out of, like, Chardonnay. We're replacing it with St. Pepin. That's we grow here. So varietals that are harder to get with travel across the United States, like what we're custom growing in Washington State, we've been slowly transitioning to more Wisconsin varietals.
And you've had a great relationship, Philippe, with Wisconsin products, Wisconsin farmers, and so forth for many a year.
Yeah, many, many, many years. I mean, you know, this Wisconsin is our home. It's our roots. We use Wisconsin oak barrels in the wines, in the bourbon, in the brandy, locally grown product. Our son Roman at the bistro is using lots of locally grown ingredient. Flour for the bread is all locally grown. Just promoting Wisconsin as a great state to do business, a great state to make outstanding wines. So that's been our a sense of provenance. Cultivating our roots has been a goal of ours.
When you mentioned the barrels, the oak barrels, I remember you telling me a great story about being told that, no, you couldn't make barrels out of oak. And you said, Oh, yes, you will.
Oh, yeah. I'm the guy paying the bill, so yes, you will. You will make Wisconsin oak barrels.
It is a great story. Nick emailed us, thanks for the show about wine. Nick says his claim to fame is he was the very first truck driver to deliver Wallersheim, delivering a few pallets of empty bottles that would eventually contain brandy. What hybrid cold climate varieties does Wallersheim make wine out of, such as Foch, Marquette, Petite Pearl, St. Croix?
So thanks, Nick. That is really neat to hear that you were the first delivery. That's so cool. We grow Maréchal Foch, Leon Mieux, Marquette, Crimson Pearl, and Petite Pearl, but Foch is really our main red here. We also have St. Pepin, La Crosse, and I'm missing something.
Brianna.
Thank you. Brianna.
There you go. Thanks, Nick, for calling. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or like Nick, you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mieler for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk wines, grapes, and winemaking with our two guests today, Philippe Coquart, president and winemaker at Wallersheim Winery and Distillery in Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin. Céline Coquart-Zenners is the head winemaker at Wallersheim Winery. So talking wine with them, and if you want to join in, the number's 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly, or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a question from or a comment from Ramsey in Fish Creek. Hi, Ramsey.
Hey, I'm just wondering, we have all these wineries up here, but they're all fruit wineries, and we're the same latitude as some great wineries in Washington State, for instance. But maybe it's a progression thing. We don't know what we're doing up here. But most of the wines up here are, unless you're the sweet wines, they're awful. There's nothing.
There's not a lot of imagination. It sounds like that's Ramsey's comment. Philippe, let's turn to you first.
Yeah. So, I mean, Wisconsin is by far not the easiest place to grow grapes because of the limited choice we have for a cultivar. So when we talk West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, even some places in Michigan, Wisconsin cannot grow the Pinot Noir, the Pinot Grigio, the Chardonnay, the Gewurz, and the Malbec, and so on. So we have to rely on grapes that can take cold winter. And there are a lot of those grapes. Yes, there are a lot of fruit wine. There are a lot of sweet wine. But, you know, that's a personal taste. It's a personal choice. And, you know, being a grape wine advocate, if it's well made, it has the right balance, the right taste, and doesn't have any flaws like vinegar or too light or out of balance. It's about, ultimately, it's about the quality of the product, the quality of the wine. So we are encouraging everybody to consume Wisconsin-made wine. It doesn't matter the color, the brand, and so on. Let's support Wisconsin growers, and there's a lot of choice. So in our opinion, it's going the right direction.
Yeah, and do you know off the top of your head how many wineries there are in the state? There's got to be quite a number. Céline, do you know, or Bob?
Yeah. We're about over 120 right now.
Wow.
And Larry, there were When I came on board in 1984 in the state of Wisconsin, I think we had 8 wineries. And in the 90s, it was like 25-ish. And then after that, it exploded. And not only in Wisconsin, but nationwide. Nationwide from, let's say, 2000 to today, the number of wineries has quadrupled in the entire nation. It does Iowa, New York, Illinois, you name it, everywhere.
What are the trends you're seeing in alcohol? Is an email. What are you seeing in terms of alcohol consumption nationwide? Celine?
Generally,
go ahead.
Generally, we're seeing a decrease in alcohol consumption. After COVID and a lot of drinking at home, I think people have felt like they needed to take a step back from that. And it's not just wine. It's also beer, it's spirits, it's all alcohol beverages. And it's happening globally. It's not just something that's happening to us here in the United States. In France, thousands of acres of vines are being pulled out. One of our growers in Washington is pulling out grapes. So it's happening everywhere. And slowly, well, as the younger generation comes on, you know, into drinking age, right now they're tending towards more of the sweet and bubbly drinks. But as time goes, the trend usually follows that there's some interest in wine.
Do you guys make a non-alcoholic wine?
No, we don't. We have a grape juice, but we do not make non-alcoholic wine. It is the only non-alcoholic wine right now coming from Germany or Europe. They are usually white and bubbly. It has been a quality problem to make a great non-alcoholic. You basically have to make a wine, strip the alcohol out, and rebuild the flavor. And it is not up to a winery. Winery do not have the ability to do such thing. You would have to be a manufacturing, you would have to be a bottling plant. They are stuff that you have to put in those wines that I don't think you want to drink. And we are not touching that. We'd rather encourage people to drink lower alcohol wine, like the local that Celine was talking about, which is 8.7% of alcohol. The Prairie Fumé is only 10% of alcohol. Let's try those wines rather than a 14, 15% of alcohol wine. That's the direction we are going.
In another email, Willem and Colfax wondering, now this is about cognac, wonders what kinds of grapes does it take to make cognac, and do you make it, and how does it, and does cognac need to come from a certain region to be called cognac?
Okay, so cognac is only made in the region of France. So that is a quote-unquote protected name, and it can only, if it is called cognac, it can only come from the region of cognac. In cognac, they grow a lot of Uni Blanc grapes. It's a big cluster, lots of volume, and it is grown for its high acidity and low sugar. And our emulation for cognac here in Wisconsin is the Coquart brandy, and as well as the Press House brandy, which is all white grapes picked early. La Crosse is used for us, San Pepin is used, Brianna, all native Wisconsin grapes picked early to have less alcohol, and it makes a finer brandy, which ages in the barrels 2 to 8 years to have the our brandy product.
Yeah, I have a bottle of each of those at home, as a matter of fact, and they're very, very good brandies for sure. So the trends in Celine and just in general, is what are you seeing?
Since we're seeing less drinking overall, bottle sales everywhere have gone down. But the upside to that is people are really coming out to seek an experience and interact with what we have here, with the vintage winery, with the bistro. So really turning towards food and tasting experiences instead of, you know, taking bottles upon bottles home. And that's okay too, you know, whatever people need to do for their families and just to enjoy themselves in a different way, maybe perceiving it a little bit differently.
You know what? Treble in Lodi has a comment that kind of goes along with what you're talking about here. Treble, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
And you've got,
you want me?
Yeah, you've got an experience to share.
Yes, I'm somebody that is a wine lover, and I drink wine every day with my food and my family. Over the decades, has always served wine with dinner, and my grandparents lived to be in their 90s, both grandfather and grandmother, and I am recoiled when people talk about wine as just alcohol, and I see it as food, and that was what I wanted to bring up and share and see what your guests felt about that.
Yeah. Well, wine is food.
Wine is food. Wine is history. Wine is culture. Wine is also in the Bible so many thousands of times. Wine is part of life and part of food. I mean, we always encourage to have wine with food and food with wine. You don't have to get very sophisticated in the pairing and, you know, red with red meat, white. And Celine can expand on that because we have a lot of fun mixing and matching and changing and experimenting with different wine and food. But wine and food are the best thing that can happen. Wine gather peoples. Sometimes you don't even need to speak the same language. You bring a bottle of wine and everybody becomes friend. For us, it's really a culture and part of life.
Yeah. Celine, you're nodding in agreement there.
Yeah. For us, you know, wine and food is our family. We never have one without the other. And as winemakers too, you know, we agree calling wine just alcohol doesn't really do it justice. It starts with the farming in the vineyard. You know, that's an entire year, decades worth of farming for one particular block of vines. And so for us, you know, making wine, we kind of look at it as a time capsule too. So, you know, there was a drought the year my son was born, and we have that vintage and think, oh yeah, this is a lot riper than, you know, the year that my daughter was born when we had a lot of frost and, you know, lost a lot of buds and a lot of fruit for the following season. So for us, it's not just the food and the wine, but also kind of a historical piece for our family, kind of like a family time capsule for every season.
Yeah. So the you mentioned the vines and, you know, various years. How are the vines doing this year?
Really nice. And that's something, you know, we can remind all the listeners that it is time to prune the vines. It is happening right now. We are done with our 30-acre block. Up going above the Dales and further north, you still have another month to do that. The vines are looking good. We are doing lots of different and new things in the vineyard, walking away from commercial herbicides, or less and less. I mean, we've done mulching for 25 years. We are going to experiment with some cocoa disc as a mat underneath the vine to suppress the weeds. We're doing local composted manure instead of the standard NPK. We have a complement of NPK with the manure, but half of the fertilization to the vine will be coming from cow manure. Planting radishes, all sorts of new things. But the vineyard is looking good right now, and we hope for no frost.
Yeah, and by the way, Treble, thank you very much again for calling. I'm sorry I didn't thank you for that call. Marsha had emailed us. They're located in the Wausau area. They found a wild grapevine growing in their backyard, which faces south and gets full sun, and it seems to be now trying to grow up into a flowering crab tree. How do you figure out what type of grapevine it is? Should they construct something to help the vine flourish? There are also wild raspberry canes in this area.
It's always fun to find a mystery vine. There are a few labs that can identify using DNA. I can look that up, and I can send Larry that, and they can share that to you, Marsha, from your email. Otherwise, if you can look at the shape of the leaves, the size of the leaves, how big the flower clusters are, and then when the fruit comes out, you might be able to get an approximation, but it is probably some wild riparian vine. They're really hard to identify unless you send it in for DNA testing.
I would cut it out. I'd get rid of it. You know, I've tasted some really bad wine from while it just grows as an ivy. It chokes the trees. I would get rid of it.
Oh, there you go, Marsha. And, you know, gardeners, they're always experimenters. They always want to try something. But at least it's only one vine, and you maybe experiment with it and then get rid of it after you taste the grapes. So there you go. Oh, man, you can join in, too, number 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You mentioned pruning. And what are, you know, for those who have grapes, grapevines, it's a good time to be pruning them. What are the tips for pruning the vines?
I think there are two tips. Number one, it's got to be done every year. Learning how to identify last year's growth. And it will be a smooth shoot or a smooth branch without any peeling bark. And you will prune on that. So you will prune with that. And you can leave a lot of little sticks that have two or three buds on with that smooth bark and not the peeling bark. The peeling bark would be 2 years old, 3 years old, and there will be no fruit coming out of those branches. The fruit only comes out of last year's growth. And I lost the train of thought, but it needs to be done every year. Oh, and you basically have to remove 80% of last year's growth to end up with the appropriate number of buds that will ensure fruit quality, sunlight penetration, and so on.
When it's harvest, here's another question. When it's from an emailer, when it's harvest time, how do you harvest the grapes, Celine?
We have two ways of harvesting. So in the weeks leading up to harvest, once the grapes start changing color on the vine, we'll go through and we will sample every different block for sugar and acid and also taste all the way through. Early on when they're not very ripe, it leads to a lot of stomach aches. So it's always more fun as it gets a little sweeter. Once we see what that is and understand the balance, all of those harvest dates will be planned based on the wine that we want to make from those grapes. So the balance of the sugar and the acid and the alcohol that we want to get from those. So when we're ready to harvest, we will either harvest by hand on all of our steepest slopes, or we have an over-the-row picker that can drive right over the top and has these flexible rods that strip the grapes off the clusters and bring them into a bin that we bring into the winery.
You should talk, Celine, about the, and you mentioned kind of in passing when we were talking about food and wine together. You guys have some fantastic opportunities for people to visit and sample and some lovely food as well, I can attest to.
Thank you. My brother, Roman, our chef, started the bistro 6 years ago, and we have lots of food, flatbreads, soup sandwiches, different salads, wraps, and a brandy old-fashioned cookie, which is really admittedly good. A favorite.
It's really good.
It's fantastic. And lots of homemade breads, always a baguette. There's some wine butter that's fantastic. So we have food from noon to 3 during the winter season. Pretty soon we'll be open from noon to 4:30 in the bistro, the kitchen. Otherwise, we're open from noon to 5. There are tours, tastings. There's a beautiful old historic vintage winery where the bistro is housed, and our cellars are in the basement of that. And then we also have the distillery across the way with cocktails and snacks and some tours and viewing windows so you can see what the guys are up to day to day. And then we have lovely flowers and grounds and a cave up on top of the hill with a view from of the river from the top of the bluff there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful view. It really is. And the food is very good as well. And that's kind of year-round now.
It is year-round. We're only closed Easter, New Year's, Thanksgiving, and Christmas.
Yeah. Jim in Dodge County has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Thanks very much. Your comments about pruning were spot on. It's exactly the help I needed. My other question is that we've had problems with bug pests. And as you might guess, the Japanese beetle is one of those. And then 1 year, kind of unusual, and we have been handpicking those beetles, something ate the blossoms before they ever got to go to fruit. And I talked to a local fellow, and he thought, well, maybe that was a flea beetle. Well, at any rate, so we have tried the powders and such on there. And then the only thing that has worked reasonably well was a gauze shield over the top of it, that lightweight gauze. We just make a complete tent over the top of the grapevine, and that stopped the bugs, but I suspect that it's cut down on my yield. It hasn't been very great since then. And so do you suggest that we not do that, or that we only leave it on for a period of time and then take it off?
Yeah.
How many vines do you have, Jim?
Just one.
Okay. So for Japanese beetle, you can buy the commercial lures, and it'll smell like a whole, like you walked into a flower shop, this little lure, and then it funnels the beetles into a bag. That is one way. It's controversial on whether it attracts more beetles to the vine or not. So if you're going to use that, I would put that in an area of the yard that's not too close to that vine. There are also kaolin clay that can be sprayed over the vine that acts as a deterrent to the Japanese beetles against eating the leaves. It kind of irritates them. They don't notice it quite as much, but every time it rains, it needs to be reapplied. And those are just non-chemical ways of doing it. Of course, there are always sprays. If you're going to go that route, you need to make sure you're doing it when the beetles are actually on the vine. So usually the afternoon hours when it's warmest and sunniest, and they're all emerged from the sod underneath the vine. As to the bloom question, I'll let Philippe answer that one.
Yeah, what do you think, Philippe?
Well, I don't think the netting should affect the bloom and the fecundation of the fruit. Because vines, unless they are, what do you know which cultivar they are, Jim?
No, I'm sorry. It was here when we moved in and we just use it.
Yeah.
We don't have to see.
So, you know, my gut feel is it's a Concord, and it should pollinate by itself. It's maybe more a nutrition issue. What I would do is really encourage you to keep the vines open, what we call combing, removing a few leaves, letting the sun penetrate inside the vine. It dries out the vine. Then you don't have to use a spray. It could be, I think Celine has a couple of ideas.
If it is a Concord, you might want to see how far back you're pruning it. Concord is more fruitful on the fourth through the eighth buds on the cane. So if you prune it back too far, you might not get much fruit on it the way we would prune Foch or St. Pepin, where we're pruning to two or three buds on a cane. The other thing I was thinking, which is something we've started in our vineyard here against Japanese beetle eggs in the sod, is using nematodes that eat chitin, which is part of the little shell of the egg. And you can find nematodes, beneficial nematodes, at garden supply centers if that's something you want to apply, not just beneficial for your vines, but other garden and flower areas as well.
Yeah, and Jim here, he's got one vine, so I wouldn't think it'd be too expensive to have to use those nematodes as well. Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Beyond grapes, John wonders, what other ingredients do you find in wine?
Wow, that's a great question. Wine is 100% grapes. Water is not part of it. Outside of the washing of the tanks, yeast are added. Sugar can be added if needed. Sulfite is always a question. Yes, we do use sulfite, but it is also naturally produced in the soil. Sulfur from the soil becomes sulfites. And wine is, in my opinion, one of those untouched and quite natural product directly from the vine. And sometimes it just let it be and don't mess with it.
We have two guests for you today, Philippe Coquart and Celine Coquart-Leonards, and they are, of course, very active in the Wallersheim wineries. Great to have them with us. You can join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking wine and winemaking and, of course, grapes and dealing with the grapes that you may have in your yard with our guests, Philippe Coquart and Celine Coquart-Leonards from the Wallersheim Winery. And again, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Jennifer in Eau Claire emailed us. They have a grape pergola in their yard, and one year the grapes were purple, but last year they were green, and she says all season long and wonders how can that be.
Too much shade.
Yeah,
too much shade. Those pergola, I mean, they have grape pergola, table grapes, Concord grapes, vineyard grapes, wine grapes, they have to be pruned every year. You have to allow the sunlight to ripen the grapes. And it would be exactly the same on our vine if we were to not do the combing, leaf removal, optimizing sunlight penetration inside the vine. The red grapes would be white and pink in September. If you have more than three layers of leaves, the grapes will not see the sun. So it's all about creating some holes and letting the sunlight to ripen the grapes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Renee emailed us. She loves wine, but she gets a headache every time she drinks even one glass. And wonders why the heck that's the case. And she also says that people are friends who have gone to Italy who used to get headaches when they drink the wine in Italy, they don't get a headache. And Celine, you want to comment?
Yeah, there's a pretty common misconception that headaches are caused by sulfites in wine. And while there are some truly sensitive people that have a sulfite allergy, typically the amount of sulfite in wine is so much lower, like 100 times lower than what you would find on dried fruit, dried apricots, French fries in the freezer section. So it is quite lower. Typically what causes a headache from wine is histamines. And that usually happens with red wines. And red wines are lower in sulfite than white wines typically because of the tannin, but they are higher in histamines because of the yeast and the fermentation process typically. And that usually has something to do with yeast nutrition. So unfortunately, that's not something that you can really tell when you're picking up a bottle of wine. So it's just knowing producers that you like and who doesn't give you a headache, I guess. Of course, there's always the dehydration that comes with that too, but it's typically a histamine reaction.
Jeff in Dodgeville will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I've got a question. I've heard in the Middle Eastern countries and Eastern Europe, they graft domestic grapes, or in my case, Northern Wisconsin hardy tasty grape to a wild grapevine and get good results. Do you have any experience with that and any recommendations? I'll hang on.
Great question. Yes, grafting has been used for centuries. It is a great tool. One of the main reasons for grafting American rootstock on other cultivar is for the phylloxera resistance, which is an aphid feeding on the roots. Grafting will also help fighting soil salinity, reduce vigor in rich soil. So grafting can be used for many, many things. And we had some grafted vine did extremely well for 30-some years. We ended up pulling this vineyard out, but the first 25 years, it was just lots of vigor and proving that they were that the roots were not sensitive to phylloxera. So it can be done, it's a great tool. So I would encourage you to you could graft a Foch, you could graft a St. Pepin or Lacrosse on a wide rootstock. It can be done.
Is it difficult, the whole grafting process? Probably should get some direction on that.
No, not really, not very difficult. You need a really sharp knife. You create an incision in the part that is going to stay rooted. You insert a stick exactly of the same size, same diameter, and you can wrap it with some kind of tape. And just watch it grow. You might need five trial and two will take, but it certainly can be done.
listener called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering if your gift shop still sells things made out of wine barrels.
Oh, yes, we do. We have a genius guy on site by the name of Tommy Meyer. He's the one creating the trays, the coat rack, the candle holder, chairs, tables, mini bar made out of barrels that we have used. And after 6-7 years, when we no longer need the barrel, then we retire them. We can stencil a nice distillery logo, Wolosham Winery logo on them, or we make furniture out of them. So, yes, we still have, year-round, we have those objects.
And somebody else is wondering about one of your wines, and what type of wine do you recommend for Easter ham?
We love ham and Easter lamb as well. We often have Pinot Noir with ham, or if you're doing lamb for Easter, it's a great option. If you have any Ruby Novo left from, which is the first wine released of the new vintage, that's a great option. Something like a Beaujolais. So something like a lighter red. Pinot tends to have less tannins, or something that's only been aged in the barrels a few months or not at all. Any of those light reds would be a great option. They're fruity. They're not too tannic, so they won't be too drying. They'll play well with the sweetness of the ham.
I always look forward to the Ruby Novo.
That's, us too.
That is something I look forward to every single year. Well, you know, how's business been? I mean, it's, you know, we talked earlier about some of the problems or some of the changes in people's approaches to wine and other alcohol, for that matter.
You know, Larry, in all honesty and transparency, it's concerning. You know, I mean, I would love to say, oh, it's good. It's okay. And we are not the only one. You know, we see stats throughout Wisconsin. We see stats throughout the nation. Like Celine was explaining, in Washington State, they have pooled 10,000 acres of Cabernet grapes last year. They were requested to pull another 7,000 this year. It's not looking great. And, you know, all the retailers, all the restaurants are concerned. When you have less wine or less cocktail at a restaurant, it's less tips. The bill is a lot smaller. There is good profit on wine and cocktail at restaurants, and it hurts everybody's business. Distributors are concerned. It's affecting a huge segment of the food and wine and beverage population. You know, so we are hoping for a turnaround. We are really encouraging people to support locally made wines. And, you know, it's not a quantity, but it's a quality. We see the price point in the 12 to 20 continuing to do well. The high price point are hurting. So we hope for a better days.
We'll talk with you both again. Thank you so much. Philippe Coquart and Celine Coquart-Lennertz, our guests today from the Wollersheim Winery. And by the way, a full disclosure, we should mention that Wollersheim Winery is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. And we'll get them back again, and we'll talk more about wines and winemaking with them. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.